This episode is brought to you by Dietz and Watson.
Molly, it's time we have the talk about hot dogs.
Okay. Well, hey, I'm looking for a hot dog that's the real deal, Matthew.
Like a classic hot dog that, like, when you think of, like, the platonic ideal of a hot dog, I recommend Dietz and Watson's Dietz Dogs.
Ah, well, I've heard that they're handcrafted and made using only Dietz and Watson premium meat.
I can vouch for this because Dietz and Watson sent us a big box of hot dogs and other delights, and wife of the show, Lori, and I had them for dinner last night. We had the classic beef Dietz dogs with toasted buns with sauerkraut and pickled jalapenos and Dietz and Watson ballpark-style yellow mustard.
Do you think you'd recommend Dietz and Watson hot dogs for fried rice?
Oh, yeah. Fried rice with some sliced hot dogs. I'm going to be doing that soon. Wife of the show, Lori, is going to be making the hot dog flour buns from Christina Cho's cookbook, Mooncakes and Milk Bread. Very excited for this.
And I'm especially pleased because Dietz and Watson does things the right way. So this means, like, no additives, no fillers, no artificial flavors, no cutting corners. You can feel good about this stuff.
Dietz and Watson. It's a family thing since 1939.
Shop now at dietzandwatson.com/the right way.
That's Dietz, D-I-E-T-Z, and watson.com/the right way. I'm Matthew.
And I'm Molly.
And this is Spilled Milk, the show where we cook something delicious, eat it all, and you can't have any.
Today, we are talking about gumbo, and we have a special guest who we are very excited to talk with.
Yeah, we're very excited in part because we know so little about gumbo, but we knew we needed to do an episode on it.
This is true. And also, this guest, I think, is the perfect person to talk with us about gumbo because he is from small town Louisiana. Also, Matthew, you and I are both fans of this guy's music.
Yes. And so, yeah, I'll try not to, like, detour, derail the conversation into just trying to talk to him about singing for half an hour.
Should I tell the listener who he is?
Fine.
Okay. We are going to be bringing on Durand Jones here soon. We're all going to learn a lot about gumbo. He has a wonderful gumbo recipe that we will be discussing.
Okay. I'm really excited for this. Okay. Let's start with memory lane. I did not grow up in small town Louisiana. How about you?
I did not. I grew up in a mid-sized town, Oklahoma. I think I went to Louisiana for the first time as, like, a kid. I went to Baton Rouge, but I really don't remember anything about it. So this is really useful for our memory lane.
Okay.
And then I do remember going to New Orleans with my dear friend Ben in 2016. We met up there. We sort of ate our way
through the city. Is this Ben who you ate hot dogs at a Las Vegas buffet with?
That's right. I do all my best eating with Ben and with you. Anyway, Ben and I met up in New Orleans, and, you know, we did all kinds of things, like the 25-cent martini lunch at Commander's Palace. I don't like martinis, though.
Yeah, I don't either. I hate them.
And what else did we do? Oh, Ben bought some cigars, and I attempted to smoke a cigar on the,
that sounds, like, gross also,
the stoop of the Airbnb we rented. And at some point, I ate gumbo, and I cannot for the life of me remember where it was, but it was delicious.
Okay, but yeah, like, I think one of the great things about New Orleans is, like, you know, there are, like, special restaurants, but also, like, the, like, base quality of food is so high. Like, the only gumbos I remember in New Orleans were just at, like, neighborhood places that, like, if you mentioned the name, no one from outside of town is going to know it.
You know what? I feel pretty certain, actually, that my gumbo was at Dookie Chase's.
Oh, okay. That is a famous place.
That is a famous place. And I feel pretty certain that it was there as part of, like, their lunch one day.
Yeah.
It was epic.
Can I do a little martini memory lane since you brought it up?
Yeah, like, yeah.
I have, like, a memory of going to this place in Portland with some friends when I was maybe just, like, senior year of high school, and, like, one of our friends was 21 and ordered a martini and, like, surreptitiously let me have a taste, and I was like, this is so disgusting. Like, how could anyone like this? And, like, there are many things like that that you taste when you're young, and then, like, you learn to like them. For me and martinis, nope.
You know, it always looks so good in the glass.
Of course. Yeah, it looks beautiful.
God, it looks so good in the glass. And I like vermouth. I like gin. I'm fine with vodka. I could take it or leave it. I like olives. I don't really know what my problem is, but you put it all together and it doesn't.
Yeah, not, I don't,
well, you
like
don't put
olives.
All those things together, but you put some of those things together and it makes a martini. And I don't like
it. Okay, we should probably do a martini episode at some point. I think it would be fun.
Let's do it. Okay, let's do it. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Okay. So as we were like talking about this episode, I remembered that in John Thorne's book, Serious Pig, he devotes a whole like third of the book to the food of Louisiana, like Cajun and Creole food, not because he's from there, but because he just loves it and has spent time there. And one of the essays in the book, which is like shorter than I remembered, is about gumbo. And I'm going to be drawing from it a bit. And so like, to be clear, John Thorne is a white guy who is not from Louisiana, but he is really careful in the essay to cite primary sources and give credit to the black cooks and writers who invented gumbo and developed its infinite variations. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, one thing I realized, like wife of the show, Lori asked me, okay, so what is gumbo? And I'm like, that's not a super easy question to answer, but we'll try.
Okay.
So in the John Thorne essay, he quotes William Faulkner Rushton. Great name.
Is this different from William Faulkner?
Different from William Faulkner. Okay. Probably named for him. He was a historian. Okay. And he wrote a book called The Cajuns that's like a history of Cajun culture and people. And there's this quote from it that goes like this. When Ruth Fontenot sets out to cook a gumbo, all the pots and pans and spices in her kitchen sit up and take notice. None is certain which one or ones will be used this time around, for both the recipe and the size of the serving will vary from day to day, depending on Ruth's mood and assessments of the tastes of her dinner guests. That really sums up gumbo as much as any like specifics about the dish that we're going to talk about today.
Oh, wait a minute. I just remembered somewhere else I had gumbo.
Okay, let's hear it.
Oh, wow. Okay, this time, there was something about like the pots and pans and the guests, the number of guests varying that made me remember this. Okay, I think, I can't remember when this was. But anyway.
Oh, also, I forgot to do my memory lane.
I was lucky enough to have gumbo at the table of Pablo Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
Who is also a white man in Louisiana. Incredible cook. And Pablo made his standard gumbo. And then I think he also made a vegetarian version because there was somebody coming to dinner that night who was vegetarian. But anyway, I had the regular gumbo. And Pablo has a pretty small kitchen. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing, like the heat and humidity in this kitchen. I think it was a spring evening. It was a Monday. Pablo, at least at the time that I knew him better, was doing like Monday dinners often and just sort of inviting whoever was around. Anyway, giant pot of gumbo, big old pot of rice. And it was so hot, and yet eating like a hot, meaty soup felt like exactly the right thing to do.
Yeah. Okay. So, I wish I'd been there.
Have you met Pablo?
I've never met Pablo, but I've read a bunch of his writing and he's great.
Oh, he's fantastic. Yeah.
Okay. So my memory lane, the only time I've been to Louisiana, went to New Orleans with friends in 2002. We ate really well. And yeah, like I know we did have lunch at Commander's Palace. And like we went to at least one other famous chef kind of place. But the gumbo I remember having was just at like, you know, this place looks like it might be good for dinner. Let's wander in here. And it was always great. Like I remember having a crawfish etouffee that was amazing, but also just like several different types of gumbo, all of them good, always served with rice.
Fantastic.
And I've never cooked it.
Where does this word come from?
Oh, are you summoning Mr. Etymology?
I am. Is he here?
Okay. He's here.
Okay.
I'm not going to do the voice because I don't remember what it was.
Okay.
Okay. So the etymology of the word gumbo is pretty straightforward with one little twist. So we are 99% sure that it comes from the Bantu language family word kingombo, which appears in different forms in different Bantu languages. The Bantu language families from the Niger-Congo region in sub-Saharan Africa mainly. And that word means okra in the Bantu language family.
Okay.
And the word gombo also means okra in French.
Oh.
However, sassafras in the form of filet powder is a very common ingredient in gumbo. And the Choctaw Native American nation contributed a lot to Cajun and Creole cuisine. And the word for sassafras in Choctaw is combo. We, it's
what,
genuinely.
What are the chances?
It's is that- like, you know, there are a lot of words in the world, but there aren't that many different ways you could put together words. And this genuinely seems to be a weird linguistic coincidence, since there is so much evidence linking the word to okra and West Africa.
That is wow.
Yeah, it is. Okay. It is wild. Like, I'm not going to say like I'm 100% sure, like I am not an authority on this. Like, it is possible that that the Choctaw word contributed, but it seems like it's really a West African word.
Sure. So this is the official state food of Louisiana.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I would say gumbo is a stew, both in the literal sense and kind of the figurative multicultural sense, because a lot of different cooking traditions went into what it is today.
Like, which ones?
Okay. So definitely West African and African American traditions, Choctaw, French, Spanish, like all of the cultures that created what we know as Louisiana today created mm-hmm. gumbo.
Okay. Do you have any sense of how long this stuff has been being made?
So that is a really good question. Like, definitely at least a couple of centuries. Like, yeah. there are kind of some things about it that are relatively modern in terms of, like, it is a, you know, we're going to talk about like country and city gumbo, but especially like the city style gumbo that people outside Louisiana associate with gumbo is kind of a like rich dish. Mm-hmm. And so like, you know, it's something that like, you know, requires sort of like modern access to like cooking fats. Mm-hmm. So is probably in current form dates from the 19th century.
Okay. And so there are commonalities, though, to the way that they're always made, right? There's yeah. always a roux.
Yep. Okay. Although when we talk to Duran, we're gonna see there's like more than one way to make a roux. But like, gumbo typically starts with a brown roux. So like mm-hmm. cooking flour and vegetable oil down in a pot, like almost never butter, unless it's like someone's like fancy recipe that like locals are probably going to make fun of. Like, it is vegetable oil and flour cooked for a long time, like maybe 45 minutes until it's really like brown and toasty. Mm-hmm. And that is like why gumbo has like this thick brown broth sauce. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. But there's more to the thickness than that, which we'll get.
Okay. Okay. And then what about like the base vegetables? You know, like, what do you start with?
Yeah. So always like the Louisiana Holy Trinity, onion, celery, and green bell pepper.
I love that there's like a holy trinity in so many different cuisines.
Yeah. So and like the way it usually, the mirepoix usually gets worked in is, it's interesting. And like having not made it, I didn't know this. Like, usually you cook down the roux, and then when the roux is ready, then you throw in the mirepoix and you cook that in the roux, sort of like using that oily roux as a cooking medium, because it's really
interesting.
Hot.
Interesting. Yeah. 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 Okay. This is fascinating. So it must be real ugly when you first start out. You got this like brown slurry.
Oh, yeah, like a fantastic smelling sludge. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And
okay.
Then you're going to add stock and like long cooking proteins and cook it for like, you know, chicken, cook it for up to 3 hours. Okay. And the spices, like there's going to be some Cajun spices that go in with the, I should say, not necessarily Cajun. There's going to be Louisiana spices that go in with the mirepoix or at the end or both. Mm-hmm. Like if you're adding seafood, which many gumbos have, that's going to get added near the end so it doesn't overcook. And sure. You serve it with rice.
What could be better?
Yeah.
So where does okra come into this?
Okay. So in addition to the roux, like, you know, because it's made with this thick brown roux, like that's going to add some texture, some like, I don't know, like, you know, when you make like a stew that starts with flour, it's got kind of a... like a smooth thickness to it. And mm-hmm. then you're probably going to add some other type of thickener, and that's going to be okra or filet powder or occasionally both. So okay. Here comes some sweeping generalizations.
Okay.
So okra is associated with city gumbo, which is most likely to be made in New Orleans and is more likely to include seafood and fresh sausage. And filet powder, which is made from dried and ground sassafras leaves, that goes into country gumbo, which is more likely to be made outside the cities and more likely to include chicken and smoked sausage. So like andouille sausage, for example.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So I'm guessing I've never had country gumbo then.
I don't think I have either. And okay. Country gumbo was originally made without a roux, I learned, because flour was scarce in rural areas. But nowadays is usually made with a roux and filet powder. So,
okay, wait, have you ever smelled filet powder or
I
like
don't
tasted
think I
it?
Have.
Or, God,
we are so qualified to
God,
this episode.
What do sassafras leaves taste like? Have you eaten any of those?
Just like right off the tree, like I'm like a koala or something. Yeah, I'm a koala.
Okay.
All right. So both like filet powder and okra both add like a unique flavor and texture. So filet powder is added at the end because it gets like gloopy and the flavor cooks out if you add it too soon. And like even like places will like put it on the table to like sprinkle on your gumbo and stir in.
Oh, okay.
So sassafras is the main flavoring that we think of when you think of like the smell and taste of root beer.
Is it poisonous?
Oh, so
or
like
the bark.
The bark is poisonous. Like, you know, it's like carcinogenic in certain forms, but like filet powder is safe and like has been like determined to be safe in labs.
Okay. And so, okay, wait, hold on. So does the filet powder taste anything like root beer? I think we're talking bark versus leaves.
My impression from reading up about this is that it does. It's like a savory, herby, root beery flavor and produces like a starch thickened texture. Like if you imagine like a Chinese stir fry with a sauce that's been thickened with cornstarch or arrowroot, that kind of texture. And then okra, you know, the texture of okra produces like a slippery okra-y texture.
That's right.
And like, I really tried hard to like come up with descriptions for okra texture that didn't sound negative. And I like it.
Oh,
but
I do
like,
too.
But like describing textures in general, like the English language feels like it's kind of impoverished with like words for describing food textures.
Well, and I know that a couple months ago we mentioned that, was it a LaGaia Michon article where she wrote about sort of the way in which the American palate like doesn't know what sense to make of chewy and slippery textures.
Oh, that's such a great article. Because you can tell that we don't have enough experience with it because when you try and describe it, it sounds like you're being negative, even if you're describing something you like.
Yes.
Okay, let's pause here and bring our guest into the fold, and we're gonna talk to him about gumbo and music.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Duran Jones grew up in Hillaryville, Louisiana. He's a saxophonist, vocalist, and founder of Duran Jones and the Indications, who've released 3 critically acclaimed albums. His first solo album, Wait Till I Get Over, is out now on Dead Oceans, and it's fantastic. Deeply personal, full of vocal and instrumental hooks, and so much fun to sing along with while researching for a podcast episode. Duran Jones, thank you so much for joining us on Spilled Milk.
Thank you for having me. Super excited to be here.
All right. So on the album, you have a spoken word interlude about your hometown of Hillaryville called The Place You'd Most Like to Live. Can you start by telling us a little bit about growing up in Hillaryville, like its history, like and why you included this interlude on the album?
Yeah. Hillaryville is a very, very small incorporated town in the Atchafalaya Basin of Louisiana. The land was given to a handful of formerly enslaved folks as a form of reparations. These handful of people, about 8 or so, they came from one of the largest plantations in the country during the time called the Holmes House Plantation or the Burnside Plantation, which had over 500 slaves, 10,000 acres of sugar cane, and also 3 sugar mills that they used to process and package the sugar as well. What these formerly enslaved people did was create their own little self-sustaining town that is kind of disappearing to this day. So I really felt like it was important for me to highlight how beautiful that place is and the history of it, just to document it in hopes that it won't disappear.
Yeah.
Did you grow up eating gumbo there?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Okay.
Like every Thanksgiving, every Christmas, even on Easter sometimes, It's always a holiday celebration. Yeah.
And who would be the one who made it?
It would be my grandmother a good chunk of the time. But my stepmom would make it. I mean, everybody, it's, we have this little joke in Louisiana that everybody loves to cook, even the men, even the kids. It's a very communal thing. So learning how to make gumbo is almost an essential part of being a Louisianan.
So do you remember like how you learned to make it? Like who taught you, like what the process was like?
Oh my God. I still remember my first one. I was in college and I called my grandmother and I was like, I really want to try to make a gumbo. Can you like walk me through this? And it was pretty mid, you know, it wasn't the best.
Sure. Like the first time. Yeah, of course. Is the first time doing anything going to be perfect? I don't think so.
But yeah, over the years I've come up with my own little techniques and tricks. And some of them might, you know, raise an eyebrow to a Louisiana person.
Oh, we're going to get into it for sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But I believe in it, tried and true, that it works. So
Matthew and I have loved reading your recipe. It totally feels like the kind of recipe that you would find on like an index card, except in this case, it would be like a really big index card because your recipe is like wonderfully personal and specific to all of your, all the twists and turns you take with it. So we wanted to ask you a bunch about your recipe. Matthew, yes. Do you want to start it off?
Okay, yeah. So we, like, before you came on, we talked about some of, like, kind of the dividing lines of gumbo and wanted to ask you, where do you come down on them? So okra or filet powder, both or neither?
I am an okra guy. I don't use filet powder.
Okay.
I know some people cook with filet powder in their gumbo, but what happens when you add the filet to the actual pot is whenever you cool down your gumbo and it's in the fridge, it will gelatinize. Mm-hmm. It'll get very gelatin-like. So it's really should be used, I think, as like a seasoning condiment, like you would use hot sauce.
Mm-hmm. So at the table?
Yes. You know, pour a little bit in your bowl.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And I got a question about the okra.
Yeah. Okay.
So you mention in your recipe, one of the three steps you have you have us do first is that we cook the okra, right? We roast it in the oven.
Yes.
Does that actually remove all the slippery stuff, or do you need the slippery stuff to help do something with the texture of the finished gumbo?
It's very unappealing to have a slimy gumbo to a Louisiana person.
Okay.
And I've definitely had my few outside of Louisiana that were a little slimy.
You know? Okay, this is interesting.
Okay.
It's, it's not the vibe. And my grandmother, the way that she would always, and it's so tried and true, the way she would always cook the slime out of her okra is just to bake it in the oven for 45 to an hour. And usually it works fail proof, you know, stirring it every once in a while.
Does the slime like come out? Or does the slime like just disappear?
It just disappears. It just, it just cooks out. Yeah.
Okay.
It's great.
Okay. Seafood or chicken or both?
Both.
Okay.
All the way, baby.
Okay. Tomatoes or no tomatoes?
No tomatoes. I know there's some places that do tomatoes. There's so many different gumbos depending on the region you are in Louisiana. And there's a red gumbo out there. But for me, I'm just sticking to the rule. No tomatoes.
Okay. And the thing that I was like most interested in your recipe, which I can't wait to share this recipe with our listeners. You bake the flour rather than cooking the roux down in a pot. Like what, where did that come from? And like, and why do you do it that way? It sounds amazing.
This is the thing that I debate with so many Louisiana people. If I make gumbo for my family, I don't tell them that I'm going to use baked flour because it makes them mad. Because making a roux, it's like the first step. It's like a huge tradition in Louisiana. But I feel like I don't want to use all of that oil. I would rather use or get the oils from the chicken and the andouille sausage rather than pour in a cup of oil or two cups of oil. Because usually whenever you make a roux that way, a lot of folks have to skim the oil off of the top of their gumbo. You baking your flour? Yes. You baking your flour, you avoid all of the oil. You avoid having to skim the oil off the top of your gumbo. And I feel like it's a little healthier for you too. So.
And so then when you do use the baked flour, I saw that you add stock to the flour and kind of make like a thick slurry.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Yep. This is so cool. I've never heard of doing, I mean, I know very little about gumbo, but I've never heard of this. I would have never considered it.
Yeah.
Really fascinating.
Yeah. A good friend of mine shared this idea with me. And after doing a little research, I saw that America Test Kitchen has a great recipe for baked flour. You can just bake a bunch of it and just store it in a cool, dry place. And you'll always have some ready to go roux for you.
Excellent.
Can I ask a question about how big is the pot that you're making this in? Because I fear that, so like my largest pot is like maybe a 12 quart stock pot, but I feel like I would need to size up for this.
Yes. Google Magnolite gumbo pot and.
Okay.
Let's just do that
right
now.
That's exactly what you're going to need.
Magnolite gumbo pot.
Yes. Okay. Every Louisiana person has a Magnolite in their kitchen. If you don't, you're not a true Louisianan.
Matthew, what are you finding over there?
Like this is like a whole cookware tradition that I knew nothing about. And now that I'm looking at it, like these are like beautiful, extremely functional pieces of cookware.
Oh, yeah.
Very cool.
They're the best.
Well, will you talk about the ice water step in your gumbo? Yeah. I want to understand this. So tell us how this works, when you add it, et cetera.
Yeah, you want to have at least about 12 ounces of water. While you're cooking your gumbo, have that water in the freezer and make sure it gets really, really cold. And it's the last thing you want to put into your gumbo. A lot of folks in Louisiana feels like this shocks all of the meat. Just allows them to just absorb that flavor just a little bit more, just a little bit extra. And so shout out to the Cajun Ninja, because he is someone who's like a big proponent of that. And I am totally convinced. I deal with all my gumbos now.
So wait, is the Cajun Ninja like a YouTuber or?
He's like a social media personality guy who just cooks some Cajun food. Yeah, he's really good. He's really good.
And may we share your recipe with our listeners on our website?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay. Oh, man, I'm pumped. Okay. And Matthew, we also need to like post a link to the Magnolite gumbo situation.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. All right. So let's talk a little bit about your new record, which Molly and I have both been listening to all week, and we love it. What's a song on the record that you're especially excited about? And we'll link to the whole album, of course, but I'd love to point listeners to a favorite song.
Oh, man. I would have to say the title track, Wait Till I Get Over, is really special to me. I grew up in a backwoods country church, and every Sunday they would do this style of singing called lining hymns. And as a kid, I hated them so much. I just thought they were so boring. I thought they were like so old fashioned. Uh-huh. But now when I go back to Hillaryville and I go back home, they no longer do the lining hymns. And now I realize that the elders were trying to instill a tradition within me. And I really wanted to honor and pay homage to them on my records. So I tried to do a song loosely based in a lining hymn style.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay. Yeah. That was one of my favorites too. And I love the first song. Also, Jerry Marie, is that what it's called? Yeah. So beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
Yes. I told Molly, like, I wouldn't make you geek out on singing the whole time, but I'm a vocalist also. I love your voice. And I just want to say you got like the most like powerful A4 that just like rings out so perfectly that I wish I could do just like that.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, this record was all about being free, and I'm a loud, belty singer, and I just wanted to lean in on that a lot.
Yeah, it's great.
I also wanted to say congratulations on your first Pride and on coming out.
Ooh, thank you so much.
Yeah, I am someone who came out, well into adulthood, and it's pretty great.
Molly, thank you so much for that. This has been the most freeing year of my life.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And, yeah. And I've just been having a little hot boy summer here, you know, like,
yes.
It's just been so awesome. It's been so awesome. Pride was so lit. It was so great.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, I'm so happy for you. And I know that feeling in my own life. So yes. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you.
Duran, is there anything else you would like to plug?
I'm going to be on the road for the rest of the year, starting in Japan this week.
Oh, wow.
And headed to Newport Festival a little later, and London and Paris. I'm going to do a whole U.S. tour in September, October, and the beginning of November. So check me out, Duran-Jones.com, for the dates. I'd love to see some listeners out there.
Okay, oh, well, one more question. Now that I know you're heading to Japan, which is one of our favorite places to eat, what's something you're looking forward to eating in Japan?
Oh my gosh, there's so much. I really want to try all the regional ramens.
Oh yes.
I'm going to go to Okinawa, Osaka, and Tokyo. I'm looking at my suitcase right now. I kept the whole empty part of it because I heard about these like Michelin star. There's a Michelin star restaurant that came out with an instant ramen.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, it's yes. fairly expensive to get it shipped here, but it's super cheap over there. Like it's only a couple of yen or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And so I want to pack a bunch of those. Definitely would love to go get some great sushi.
Yeah. You're going to have a wonderful time.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, I can't wait.
My God.
I can't wait.
Amazing. Oh, have the best time.
I will.
Congratulations on the new album.
Oh, thank you so much. Really appreciate you guys.
All right, Duran, thanks again for being on Spilled Milk.
Thank you so much.
Oh, man. Duran Jones. Thank you again.
Yeah, let's see if we can get him back. And, Duran Jones is on the same record label as past guest Michelle Zauner. And just saying, if the publicist is listening, some other people on the same label are Phoebe Bridgers and Mitski. Just saying.
We'd be happy to have him on.
I wasn't even going to say that. I was just going to just saying.
Okay. That was fantastic. We will post Duran's recipe on the website. We all need to go out and get the appropriate cookware for the occasion.
Magnolite.
And
you know what? This is going to be like a joke for like two people and possibly not even a joke. But another band on Dead Oceans is Slow Dive, whose most famous album was called Souvlaki in like 1994, like classic shoegaze album. What if we got someone from Slow Dive on the show to talk about actual Souvlaki?
I think that would be great.
Okay, I'm gonna see if we can do this.
Okay.
Probably they'll say no, but.
Okay, great. All right, Matthew, do we have any spilled mail today?
We sure do. And it's very short. So we asked listeners what Spilled Milk's listeners should be called. Like I made up the term Lily, listener I'd like to yum, which you hated, but one person actually used in an email. And so far we've gotten two responses. And so it's not too late to weigh in. Contact at spilledmilkpodcast.com. What do you think a Spilled Milk listener should be called? So here's what we've got so far. Listener Megan recommends Milkmaids or CLOSMP, which stands for Collective Listeners of Spilled Milk Podcast, which is pronounced clump. The S is silent.
I really like that.
I kind of do like this one. This one goes out to the clump. Like only like, you know, longtime clompers are going to know what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You said there was another one, too.
Oh, yeah. From listener Dan.
And what's
said,
that one?
Spilksters.
Spilksters. I like it.
Yeah. Okay. I think I like all of these so far. I think I'm going to like the one I'm going to actually start saying is clomp because it's the most fun to say.
It is. Okay.
And I like the idea that rather than being a name for an individual listener, it's more of like a Borg sort of thing.
Yes.
our listeners have been assimilated into a collective.
Yes. A hive mind.
Yes. All right.
Mm-hmm. They're working hard to bring us our next episode.
That's right. Oh, wait, the way it works is like listeners, listeners are like our drones.
No, I was just imagining like this buzzing mind out mm-hmm. there that's like thinking up our next episodes.
Oh, I would love that. Thinking up episodes is hard.
It is really hard, especially when we are on number,
607.
God. Matthew, sometimes it feels like a joke how long we've been doing this show.
It does seem like a joke. And then like someone will say like, you never did an episode on like Serial. I'm like, oh my God, we never did an episode. We did do many episodes on Serial. That was a bad example. But
I think we haven't done a spaghetti episode.
That's right. And
right?
We never will.
Okay. Wow. All right. Matthew has spoken.
No, we should do a spaghetti episode.
The great and powerful Matthew.
Yeah. I'm like a, you know, don't look behind the curtain because you'll see my butt. That's what happens in Wizard of Oz, right?
That is right. That's exactly why you don't look behind the curtain.
The
wizard. Do you mean the shower curtain?
He's in the shower, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Oh, the hive mind is at work here. Okay. Speaking of things that buzz.
Yeah, you have it now, but wow.
It's called Honeybees and Distant Thunder by Riku Onda. That was the best segue we've ever done, right?
That was really good. I mean, wow.
Okay,
yes.
So this is the first, English translation for the first time in English of a book that was a massive bestseller and winner of the Naoki Prize, which is a huge literature prize in Japan when it was first published in 2016. Mm-hmm. Riku Onda, I feel like more so in Japan than in the US, like writers often work in like several different genres. I've read two previous books by Riku Onda, and one of them was like a mystery, like a really interesting, like multiple points of view, like mystery that was fantastic called The Aosawa Murders. This book is completely different. It is about three young people participating in a classical piano competition. And I'm about halfway through, and it's not really what I expected in that, like, so far, at least the drama doesn't really hang on who wins the competition. And like, if I was going to describe the book at this point, I would say it's sort of about how music can ruin your life. But if something is going to ruin your life, which it probably is, music is a pretty good choice.
So is this like a cheerful pessimism?
It's sort of a cheerful pessimism. I don't think I know that term, but I immediately get what you mean.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think you and I have both read 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman, right? Mm-hmm. I think of that as a cheerful pessimistic, pessimistic book.
That's great. Yeah, so it's about like, you know, these young people and like their relationship with music and it's a lot of stuff about classical music, which I don't think of myself as really being interested in, but like this book makes it interesting and really brings it to life. Mm-hmm. Honeybees and Distant Thunder. And also like she is just a wildly good writer and like, you know, describes things in very unexpected ways and is just like the way she describes music is extremely vivid and unexpected. And I also read her book Night Picnic in Japanese, which is also a very unusual book that I hope gets translated next because it's really good.
Wow. Okay. This is fantastic. This sounds really interesting. So that is Honeybees and Distant Thunder by Riku Onda.
Yep. And it's out now.
Great. Well, our producer is Abby Circatella.
Molly's got a newsletter that you may have already subscribed to, but if you haven't, you should, because it's called I've Got a Feeling, and it's available at mollyweisenberg.substack.com. And it's I'm always so excited when it lands in my inbox.
Oh, thanks. I'm excited that I get to write it. You know, like I wrote about food for a long time and I like writing about food. But what I really like about this Substack is I kind of get to do whatever I want.
Yeah, that's what I like about it, too. I never know what I'm going to get, but I know it's going to be something good.
Great. Thanks, Matthew.
I mentioned this a while back and may have already plugged it on the show, but it will definitely be out by the time you hear this because I'm like submitting it today. My band Early to the Airport did a cover of Robin's song Dancing on My Own with lead vocals by me, and that is
so
available wherever you get music.
All right, everybody. The band name again is Early to the Airport. Check that out. Okay, you should talk with other Spilled Milk listeners at everythingspilledmilk.reddit.com.
Yep, probably. Maybe a gumbo debate is already breaking out. That would make me so happy.
Wow, breaking out like pimples?
Maybe like everyone's breaking out and sharing like zit remedies. someone should start a thread about like what should Spilled Milk listeners be called. That would be a great way to shoot ideas back and forth.
I thought we decided on the clomp.
It's the clomp, but I still want more.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks again. We should, once again, Duran Jones's album is called Wait Till I Get Over, and you can hear that anywhere you get music, and it's fantastic. And until next time, thank you for listening to Spilled Milk.
The show that's full of sassafras.
And slime.
Yeah, I'm Molly Weisenberg.
And I'm Matthew Amster Burton.
Hey, head to tail.
Yeah. Oh, wait, there's tails? You know what? Let's grab it. Let's do an episode about Dumbo, like an elephant that can fly.
You know, we have one of those Bumbo seats.
Oh, is that? Yeah. Where you like the, you like kind of cram the baby into it.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, you know, Gumbo, Bumbo, Dumbo, Mumbo Jumbo.
Uh-huh.
What else?
Dalton Trumbo.
Who's that?
He was like an actor, maybe a screenwriter.
Okay, cool. Let's do that too.
Maybe he got like embroiled in the, Red Scare, like, McCarthyism.
Matthew, should we do this?
Let's do this.
Let's do this.